Good morning. I'm Dave, one of the pastors at High Rock, and I'm glad I get to open the scriptures today with you at Trinity Covenant. You know, our church in Arlington is usually so packed that we're building a new facility to make room for everyone and partnering with you to launch a new congregation in Lexington where we'll have space to invite even more of our neighbors. Having so many people at church can be fun. So many potential friends. And yet, it often doesn't work out that way. Many people are unpleasantly surprised to discover that even when surrounded by a large, friendly crowd, they still feel lonely somehow. Well, I won't ask you to raise hands, but odds are that many of you feel lonely. For years, we've been hearing about the epidemic of lonely older people. What's new is that recent studies have demonstrated that for most Westerners, loneliness peaks at two points in life, around age 40 and again at age 80. But the news gets worse. While loneliness peaks at those two points for every generation, researchers have discovered that with each succeeding generation, people report feeling more lonely than their predecessors did at that same age. So today's average 15 or 25-year-old feels much lonelier than today's 40 and 80-year-olds did when they were 15 and 25, suggesting that 40 and 80 will be even worse for them. 22% of millennials claim that they have zero friends. None. That's terrible. And yet, despite the 24/7 digital connections, Generation Z is even lonelier than those millennials. This means your loneliness is not your problem alone. It's a fundamental failure in current American culture. Mother Teresa, who witnessed firsthand the devastation of poverty, claimed that loneliness is far more dangerous. She lamented about America in particular that, quote, the biggest disease today is not leprosy or cancer. It's the feeling of being uncared for, unwanted, and alone. We have it worse than almost any place on earth. And this disease is killing us. In addition to rising rates of depression and suicide, lonely people also have a 26% higher risk of dying from higher blood pressure and heart disease because loneliness literally breaks our hearts. All of us know what it's like to feel lonely, which is strange because as Americans have moved from rural farms into more urban areas, we're surrounded by more people than ever. We're constantly connected by Snapchat, Instagram, email, Twitter, or cell phones. Our email boxes fill up faster than we can respond, and yet Americans are among the loneliest people on earth. One of my favorite bands growing up was The Police. They were a supergroup that sold out stadiums to adoring fans, so it's odd how many of their songs were about loneliness. And they soared to the top of the charts because those songs resonated with so many people. As Sting once sang, it seems I'm not alone in being alone. He's not alone. People in every life stage face loneliness today. Teenagers are surrounded by peers at school, and yet many of them feel desperately lonely. People in that stage of life can judge so harshly, and expectations and allegiances shift so frequently that it's impossible to know who is safe to trust. Often people who've just left college tell me that they find relationships much more difficult now. They suspect that maybe it's a defect in Boston culture. But the reality is that relationships required time and effort in college, but we had so much time with people in such a similar life stage that only minimal effort or social skill was required to make connections. After college, relationships still require time and effort, but we have less time together and less in common as we pursue separate careers. So even more effort is needed. Those of you who are single may be unsure where you'll be invited for the holidays or who will care for you when you're sick. So you assume that your burden is worse than for those who are married, but it may not be true. There's nothing more lonely than sleeping inches from someone with whom you don't know how to connect. Young couples find that it's harder to muster the energy to go out on Friday nights to nurture other friendships because it's just easier to stay home. So even if their marriage is going well, soon most couples begin to notice how lonely they are, though they aren't sure why, because they thought marriage was supposed to solve that. Having children makes relationships even more difficult because young parents lack the time and energy required to pursue friendships. Also, by that time, many Americans have chosen to buy homes far from their friends so that at the very life stage, they have the least energy for overcoming relational obstacles. They've created more obstacles than ever. And often the children parents gave up their parents and friendships for end up leaving them as adults to pursue their own lives. And the effects of divorce and death of friends or spouses, and many elders are isolated entirely. Every life stage is unique, but we all struggle with loneliness. This problem may be worsening, but it's not new. Many Bible characters also struggled with loneliness, including Moses, Job, Nehemiah, Elijah, Jeremiah. King David once cried to God, "Be gracious to me, for I'm lonely." Even Jesus wrestled with loneliness. His closest friends rarely understood him and ran away in his time of greatest needs. And this brings us back to the scripture passage we read. This winter, we're in a sermon series learning from the Bible's first church. And it seems that we have a lot to learn in this area because things seem so different for them. We just read, every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. It all sounds so joyful and relationally rich, not lonely at all. And in their case, the church was even bigger. 3,000 strangers became Christians in the first day, and more were added every day after that. Talk about making it easy to get lost in a crowd. But somehow they experienced great relationships and abounding love despite all that chaos. So what are we missing? Many people come to church expecting us to solve their loneliness problem by giving them friends, a small group, someone to pray for them or visit when they're sick. In very small churches, instead of hiring pastors who will lead them towards Jesus, often pastors are paid to be pretend friends, filling in the gaps left by our lack of actual family or friends. So they visit everybody who's lonely or sick, and they give you a ride to the airport when you're going somewhere. And when someone runs into financial hardships, they call the church office to bail them out because they don't have any friends or family to do it. That's the model many of us have gotten used to. But that's not the model we see in the original church. Instead, they created environments where people truly came to love each other and then gladly cared for and shared with each other whenever there was a need. It was like a family. So why aren't we experiencing the kind of intimate fellowship that the early church did? Why don't some of us experience church to be a family? In the current issue of The Atlantic, conservative commentator David Brooks wrote a long piece with a title I did not expect from a conservative commentator, Why the Nuclear Family Was a Mistake. We'll post a link to that article on our website, along with this sermon, but the gist of it is that when many of us hear the phrase traditional family from our pastors or politicians, we have in mind something that's actually very untraditional. Most of us think the traditional family is a nuclear family. Mom, dad, 2.9 kids, and a dog. That's God's design for a family that churches and governments are required to protect. But Brooks points out that this model really only dominated American culture from 1950 to 1965 and has been in steady decline ever since. Today, it mostly persists only among the upper and upper middle classes. For most of history, humans have lived in much larger groups. Yes, there can be a mom, dad, and kids, usually far more than two or three, as well as grandparents, uncles, aunts, adult children, and often even unrelated adults who've somehow been grafted into the family. Today, the average family in Gambia includes 13 people. That is a traditional family, even in the U.S. prior to the Second World War. These large families often aligned with a couple other large families to create a clan or tribe that all work together for the common good. A family like that is far more resilient than a nuclear family, because if one member gets sick or dies, there are others who can step in seamlessly to fill that person's role. So children experience far more stability. If someone loses a job, there are others who can pick up the slack so that person doesn't become homeless while waiting to find a new job. Older singles don't need to get married to have meaningful community because they can be part of a family without that. And young adults don't have to support themselves right away as they're starting out a new career. Elderly members continue to have an important role in the family even after they've stopped contributing financially. Brooks points out that these arrangements were very durable and provided benefits for everyone involved, but those benefits came at a price. Everyone had to learn to tolerate people of different personalities and life stages. Today, we've mostly divided up into narrow demographic categories because it's just easier for all of us. But isolating. I'm sure rambunctious 8-year-olds were just as exhausting to the 80-year-olds back then as they can be today. But they all learned to put up with each other. Another cost of committing to family is that it limited your job options. If you wanted to move to a new city for a promotion, either the entire clan had to move with you, or you had to settle for the best job you could get nearby. This is the traditional family. But after many millennia, all this changed in the 1950s when the post-war economic boom brought young families off the farms and into cities where they could make enough money to compensate for the lack of family nearby. Then, as today, among affluent families, we can pay for the services that we used to rely on extended family and clan members for. While mom and dad are working, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, and siblings can take care of the kids. But now, we pay for daycare and nannies. Or one spouse earns enough money that the other can stay home. Instead of turning to our elders for advice and encouragement, affluent people can pay therapists and life coaches. Instead of relying on the group to take care of us when we're too old or sick to work, we hold on to our own money and instead buy insurance and accumulate personal retirement accounts. We thought independence was the goal. So today, we feel alone because we are alone. But the sudden rise in income that made nuclear families possible for most Americans in the 1950s began to unravel by 1965. As real wages began falling through the 70s, most people couldn't afford the conveniences that make isolated nuclear families sustainable on their own. But we held on to that ideal as if it were God's plan somehow. Absent that wealth, many people turned to governments to supply the kind of social stability and protections that large families and clans used to through social workers and entitlement programs, which usually ends up further eroding social networks and leaves people even more isolated and vulnerable. So socialism doesn't work, but neither does a return to the traditional family touted by conservatives if they have a nuclear family in mind. No government program can compensate for all that we've lost by not living in large extended families and clans. Another current in society that increased our loneliness was the increased emphasis on individual autonomy. People left family networks to move wherever the best job was or their favorite weather. What people failed to account for was the increased social isolation this created. Into this lonely vacuum of relationships, a new cultural narrative formed that you needed to find your soulmate who will satisfy all your emotional, spiritual, social, and sexual needs. But no one person can fulfill all that. So today, the institution of marriage is being crushed under the weight of these unrealistic expectations as one person is expected to meet needs that an entire community used to. So why do we live this way? Often, our loneliness is the hidden cost of our other priorities. An extra degree, high prestige, travel every weekend, kids and a million activities, a large house, a job that pays more so that we can get an even larger house. We don't account for the sacrifices relationships with God or other people require. But we expect to fit them into the margins, which we've almost eliminated. I spoke to a former hierarcher who moved away to pursue an impressive degree he didn't need and left his close Christian friends and girlfriend to do it. 8 months later, she dumped him and he had no friends nearby and felt estranged from God. He didn't realize how life-giving those relationships were until he gave them up for a less godly goal. All this tells part of the story of how we got to be so lonely today. We've lost our clan relationships, our extended family relationships, and now our marriage relationships. No wonder we feel so lonely. Almost all of you have experienced that. Elderly people feel it. Teenagers feel it. Married people feel it. And singles do too. At some point, nearly everyone struggles with loneliness today. We're rarely alone, but we're often lonely. Is there a better way? Is there any alternative way to live? Yes, I think there is, and we see it here in Acts 2. I want you to notice the rich layers of relationships in just this one verse. Every day, they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts. First, we see that these new Christians went to the temple courts every day. The temple was massive. And in that culture, nearly everyone showed up at the two times for prayer, 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. And this is not like going to a church service. This was a mob of many thousands milling about in the temple courts. And this is where people saw their neighbors, a person they wanted to do business with, or that old family friend who knew their grandfather back in the day. It was not a place for intimate conversation, but everyone could greet each other and be reminded of their shared identity as God's people. Then we read that the Christians were together in that mob. They gathered, we'll learn in chapter 5, at Solomon's Colonnade, which was a specific place in the temple courts. This group was still very large, but they had a special devotion to each other as followers of Jesus. Beyond those relationships, they broke down further into family-sized groups that regularly met in homes and ate together. Now, this is not a nuclear family size of a mom, dad, and 2.9 kids. In that culture, a home would have consisted of anywhere from 10 to 30 people, most biologically related, but not all. As many new Christians were rejected by their biological families upon converting, they found new families within the church community. So these groups included people of every age and marital status who were committed to each other. Then, a few verses later, we're introduced to the even tighter partnership between Peter and John. Well, this may seem like a trivial observation, but I actually think it's one of the keys to unlocking the epidemic of loneliness in our churches and our culture today. No one relationship holds the secret bullet to solving loneliness. It's the thoughtful layering of relationships that enables us to flourish. There's a guy who works at a gas station I go to named McClay. We chat and tell jokes. I enjoy seeing him because we're friends. I don't know where he lives. I don't know about his dreams and disappointments, nor, him about me. We're not close, but no doubt about it, we're friends. Pastor Eugene and I, or my wife Michelle and I, are also friends. But I know them much more deeply than I know McClay. They're the people whom I've cried in front of, and with whom I've shared my sins and all my passwords. Somewhere between those two are a lot of you, whom I know well and love very much, but I don't know as well as I know Eugene or my wife. All of these are friends. But obviously, friendship is a little more complex than we sometimes give it credit for. So relying on the work of Edward Hall, Joseph Myers, and M. Scott Peck, I want to introduce you to a way of understanding relationships that may be richer than the ways we usually approach them. Because, as is often the case, modern science has arrived on the scene to discover what the ancients already knew. This slide depicts the socio-emotional walls that we build to protect ourselves from others, which psychologists sometimes refer to as ego boundaries. This illustration is intended to represent the various levels of intimacy in relationships, distinguishing how close to our hearts someone is. These various levels get populated by people. Many people are on the outside. These are casual acquaintances. You have interaction with them, but the intimacy level is low. Whenever I travel somewhere and I see somebody with a Red Sox hat, I say, "Hey, are you from Boston? Me too." We don't even know each other's names, but suddenly we feel connected. The second tier represents the slightly smaller group of friends whose names and personalities you do know, even if you don't know their deepest secrets. But you hang out and you're glad to see them. These are the people you might invite when you're going to a movie or you want to throw a big party. The third layer are your close friends, the people you live with or are in your small group. These are the people you know really well. They pray for you and you pray for them because you know each other's struggles and feel deeply connected. The fourth layer is the smallest circle, with only enough room for your best friend, your spouse, or your mom. It's the person you trust most who knows your deepest secrets and your fears. Hall and Myers suggest that across cultures, we populate these circles in similar proportions. So depending on culture and personality, like introvert or extrovert, there may be one or two people in the closest circle, 5 to 15 in the second, 25 to 120 in the next, and 125 or more in the outermost one. Sociologists refer to these levels respectively as intimate relationships, personal relationships, social relationships, and public relationships. And we see all of these in the life of Jesus. At times, he's surrounded by multitudes, numbering hundreds or thousands. Another time, he's teaching a tighter group of 72 disciples who became his primary ministry partners. Often we encounter him with his 12 hand-picked disciples. And yet within that close-knit group, he enjoys even deeper friendships with Peter, James, and John, and perhaps Peter in particular. And then Jesus reminds us that there's a fifth circle that the sociologists surely sense but don't know how to describe. This is the circle that even my spouse or closest friends will never penetrate, that deepest part of me that only God can access and understand. For this reason, we read that Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. Despite all of the crowds and close friends around him, Jesus also needed a private connection with God, just like we do. But God designed us to need other people too. So who are the people in those other four circles? At times, Jesus called these people friends. Other times, he calls them family. So which of the circles represents your friends and family? All of them. Here's the most interesting insight about all of this. If you have one or two of these circles full, maybe you have an amazing marriage and a ton of casual buddies, but you don't have that second tier filled with 5 to 15 close friends, you'll report feeling lonely on a survey. If any of the circles is underrepresented, regardless of which one, you'll experience that as loneliness, no matter how strong you are in the other levels. The problem is that most of us are really good at populating one or two of these circles and relatively weaker in another. Maybe I'm great at making buddies. I'm the life of the party, but not good at intimate relationships. So I have no one in the inner circle. Conversely, maybe I have a best friend and we do everything together. But when I want to invite a bunch of people over to a movie or to my house to play games, I don't have anybody to call because I don't have many social relationships. In either case, I'll experience that as loneliness, which other people won't understand. But you have tons of friends. You're the life of the party. But you have a great marriage. You can't be lonely. And yet, unless all the circles are adequately filled, we are. But here's the insidious part. The way most people respond to that loneliness is by investing even more effort into developing relationships on the level they're already good at. So I compensate for my lack of social friends by spending even more time with my spouse, because that's the relationship I'm more skilled at, but then can't figure out why I'm still so lonely. As you look at this graphic, in which of the levels are you relatively stronger? Which may be missing something? So where does the church come into all of this? Just being a Christian unites you with 2 billion of us around the world. So that provides a form of public relationships, like the ancient temple did. Denominations and church networks do the same thing. Interestingly, and not coincidentally, the average congregation in America is 79 people, meaning that most churches naturally meet our needs for social relationships. We hold potlucks and pass around each other's babies while we joke and enjoy each other. Trinity Covenant enjoys this culture. And this is why most churches have intuited that they need to develop small groups, tighter-knit subgroups of the church where people develop even more meaningful and vulnerable relationships, like those ancient gatherings in homes. Many people meet their spouse or best friend at church. We don't usually arrange that for people. Okay, so the Moonies do, but not many others. In any case, expecting the church to naturally fill our social circle can make things a bit confusing when people come to a larger church like High Rock Arlington. Because we're way too big to fit into your social circle. There's no way you'll ever get to know everyone. This is a large crowd of Christians, like the one gathering in Solomon's Colonnade that we read about earlier. It's valuable and enjoyable, but not especially intimate. Sensing that something's missing in that large group, most Christians seek out a small group. But doing that with total strangers is too big a jump in intimacy and commitment, so those rarely work out. In larger churches, the better first step is to find a medium-sized group. And we've tried to make that easy at High Rock by providing lots of on-ramps to many groups like that, including the youth group, men's ministry, mom's rock, kids rock, anchor, family ministry, marriage ministry, young adult ministry, and more. All of these will be available to people in Lexington as well. From there, you can meet friends with whom you want to connect at a more personal level and form a small group. And along the way, you may even find a best friend or a spouse, which would be wonderful. This is what churches can do, just like happened in Acts. We can create a culture of generosity and love among strangers, and then set up programs where Christians can meet, make connections, and learn to trust and depend on each other more deeply. So our goal is not that you'll stay in our programs forever, but that our programs can serve as petri dishes for spiritual friendships to form, at which point you won't need the program anymore. In Psalm 68, God promises to set the lonely in families. And God did that by inviting us all into His family, offering to adopt us as sons and daughters. For this reason, Christians are called the family of believers. For those who are lonely, this is a wonderful promise, but honestly, it's a strange sort of salvation because families can be a little strange. Help me out here. I'd like you to raise your hand if you've ever been in a family before. I assume that's pretty much everyone. Now, raise your hand if your family ever had some weird dynamics in it. A crazy aunt, an awkward relationship, incompatible personalities, arguing, tensions, or hurt feelings. Anybody been in a family like that? I'll bet that's also almost everyone, because every family has some difficult dynamics. And maybe this is why God says the church is a family, because it requires some hard work. We have a fantasy that families are all lovey-dovey, but real families are complicated, messy, and annoying at times, and require lots of humility and forgiveness. So these relationships won't be easy just because they're with church people. We're sinful too. They'll take effort, sacrifice, and compromise. We'll have to tolerate each other and trade some of our independence and preferences to find intimacy and commitment. In many cases, this will require some healing, because many of us have patterns of brokenness or sin that prevent us from forming relationships in certain circles. If you have a refrain about what's wrong with everybody else, it may be worth questioning if the problem is really with them. This could be a wonderful thing to explore with the High Rock guides, your small group, or some friends. It may lead to some painful conversations, but wounds from a friend can be trusted. If you've made some of these relationships a low priority over the years, no church program can compensate for that. But if you want to pursue those relationships now, our church programs can give you a great place to do that. We want you to experience this church as a family, God's family, not the nuclear family ideal of two parents, a couple of kids, isolated by themselves. This is a complex family that includes people of every age, life stage, income level, marital status, maturity level, and personality type. Some members we know well and like immediately. Others, less so. But we'll choose to love each other anyway. That's what families are like. My family has experienced that here at High Rock. Over the years, we've made so many social friends, which is spiritually essential, as well as some closer personal friends through whom God shapes, encourages, challenges, and supports us. And we them. It's taken effort and required sacrifices to keep commitments, but it's been so worth it. I have the largest nuclear family in the church, but even it's not large enough on its own. Of course kids do better with both biological parents, but they need more than that. Researchers say that the thing teenagers need to retain their faith as they mature is not a killer youth group. It's personal relationships with five Christian adults who are not their parents. Thanks be to God, my kids have found those people here and feel deeply loved by them. At High Rock and Trinity Covenant, we want to create the kind of families where the elderly, singles, rich people, poor people, teenagers, people with ties, people with tattoos, and everyone feels welcome and valued. We won't all know each other with equal intimacy, but we can build the many kinds of friendships that all of us need to flourish and find full life. Even though they still require effort, hard work, healing, and sacrifices, this opportunity for relationships is what can make churches very special places where we praise God and enjoy the favor of all the people. Now, as Robert comes forward, the band, in order to lead us, why don't I just take a moment to reflect on where have you seen this to be true? Where have you experienced rich community? And where are you missing it? What might it look like for you to take steps to be family and find family here?